This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Tracy, hello.
Good morning.
Good to see you as always.
Good to be here.
You know, I was just thinking, you or someone you know or someone in your family has had just about every disease that we talk about on this program. So, and this one I'm sure you've had. I mean, you're like a cat with nine lives,
it's
being
true.
A cancer survivor. And I'm sure you've learned a lot on this program over the years.
I certainly have. Absolutely.
How about back pain? When was the last time you had back pain?
Last night, this morning. Right. Yeah, and especially scoliosis. You know, they always say, well, if you're a tall girl, you'll have scoliosis.
You have that too?
Well, when I was a child, I was told I did, and I was told I would grow out of it. And that's as far as I've gone. So maybe today I'll learn more about it.
Yeah, I think you'll find out that's not true. But hopefully it doesn't progress as you get older, but it can. But we're going to talk to a real expert in just a little while, a spine surgeon at the Mayo Clinic. And he's going to talk to us about back pain. And what's interesting about back pain or discouraging about back pain is how common it is.
Yeah.
8 out of 10 Americans sooner or later are going to have back pain sometime during their life. And some interesting facts. It is the leading cause of disability for men over the age of 45 years old in the United States. Hmm. It's the second most common reason for a visit to a primary care physician. I suspect number one is the common cold or headache, one of the two. But it's way up there on the list of things that people go to their primary care doctor for. And here's what's really interesting, and I didn't realize, and it is the third most frequent reason people have an operation. So there's a lot of back surgery going on out there. And it is the fifth most frequent cause of ending up in the hospital.
Jeez.
So, unfortunately, the fact is that people do experience back pain quite often, and it can be a problem for many, leading even to disability, long-term disability, especially in men.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston. We're going to find out what causes most back pain and when surgery is indicated. We'll ask him about scoliosis, that's curvature of the spine. And do adults have it too, or is it just a young person's problem? And can surgery help with scoliosis, and what are some of those indications? And what about surgery for other spine problems too, like degenerative disease, spinal stenosis?
You know, that's a very common problem, particularly in older individuals, as everything degenerates just like it does as you get older, and the back is not immune to that degenerative process, mm-hmm. and it can be a real problem. Stenosis meaning narrowing of the spinal canal, which puts pressure on the nerve roots, which causes pain not only in the back but down into the legs. Difficult problem.
Wow. Well, osteoporosis too, we're going to cover that. We've got a lot to talk about this hour. But first,
guess who's in studio?
<It's>
Dr. Pratish
yes.
Dosh. You know, we've heard so much about the flu this past week, and I want to start with asking you about how early this started. Isn't this a little bit earlier than it usually comes on?
And good morning.
Well, good morning to you guys. Thanks for having me on. You know, this season has been earlier than we've seen it in previous years. In Southeast Minnesota and Rochester, really, we saw high activity starting even 3 weeks ago.
And across the state, is the whole state of Minnesota in that boat?
Yes. It looks like that Southeast Minnesota really started it, if mm-hmm. you will. And then within a week, it started to be seen elsewhere throughout the state.
And
now it's
country.
considered widespread within Minnesota, and other states, now 14 states in the United States, are considered to have widespread influenza activity.
You know, the flu is one thing, but there have been people who have died of the flu, even young people in the state of Minnesota.
It is, I think most people think about just getting the flu and
right.
sort of being in bed for
not a big deal.
Right, but we forget that tens of thousands of Americans each year are going to die from influenza. Last year was a fairly mild season. In Minnesota, we did not have any pediatric deaths. But this year already, I think we've seen two as that I'm aware of.
Right.
And so there's several reasons that, this season may be a little bit more severe than previous seasons.
Can we talk about, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say the other question is about the efficacy of the vaccine. We have heard that maybe you guys didn't guess very well this year about strains of flu.
It was me personally.
I did not sign off on that report.
You were flipping coins.
Well, first explain how we figure out what is going to be the vaccine this year versus last year versus the year before.
Sure. And so there's constant surveillance throughout the world for different influenza strains, and the virus is constantly mutating, and so
changing.
It's constantly constantly changing. Unfortunately, it takes months to grow the vaccine virus so that you can actually get a vaccine ready. So it takes months. So you got to predict several months ahead of time what you think is likely going to be the circulating strain. And usually we're pretty good just by...
Last year it was really good.
It was very, very good.
But this year not so much.
This year, early on, it was sort of a 50-50. There's two different strains that were sort of emerging up front, one of which was contained in the vaccine and the other which was not as closely related to what was in the vaccine. And it turns out that it's that latter vaccine, the latter virus, the one that's not contained in the vaccine, that seems to be predominating.
And how many strains of flu are there? I mean, how many do you have to think about and guess from, choose from, pick from?
Well, the number of strains is innumerable.
How many stars are in the sky?
Right, right.
Be a little more poetic about it.
Many different ways to say it, but the crux of this is there's a whole lot, and so it is difficult to really predict with great accuracy. And the fact that public health authorities have done it very well over the last 20, 30 years is actually a testament to how good they are. Every once in a while, a new one sneaks up on us.
I was having coffee with some girlfriends this week. There's three of us sitting at the table. Two of them, I won't tell you which ones, not me, are just deathly afraid of needles. One of them goes with the mist. The other one doesn't even get a flu shot because you can't even bear needles. And I think it's interesting that even for adults, needles are a big reason why people don't get a flu shot. So let's talk about the flu mist.
Sure. So it's a nasal live vaccine, and so versus the injectable needled vaccine. And both options are available. Live vaccine, the nasal, the mist, seems to actually have better efficacy in children. But for people who can't, for adults who cannot get, do not want to get the needle, it gives them another option.
And for kids, you use it in kids too, don't you? So they don't have to put up with a needle?
Well, there's the reason that they may not like the needle either, but there's some data that would suggest that the mist is actually preferred as a better vaccine than the needle for children.
All right. Story in USA Today. I mean, we want to hear it right from the horse's mouth. Greater than 50% of people in this country think that you can get the flu from the vaccine.
Yeah, that's certainly not true.
No way.
Part of it is that the way that the vaccine is made, we just take a piece of sort of the presenting part of the virus and it's inactivated. We injected it into people. It's just like saying that you're going to take the headlights from your car and the steering wheel apart and give it to somebody, and it's going to take them to the mall. it's really impossible to get influenza from the flu vaccine.
But there are many people who will swear up and down that they got the flu after they had the flu vaccine. So why is that?
Sure. So we give the flu vaccine in the fall.
In the fall during flu season.
Well, during cold season. So there's a lot of respiratory viruses that are circulating. And at any one time, if you look at any kids, how many of them have stuffy noses and things like that. And so you can see there's a lot of viruses that are going around. So your chances of getting a cold at any one time in the fall is pretty good, and your chances of getting a cold right after the flu shot is the same. And so people often will correlate the cold virus that they just got with actually getting influenza. Yeah.
Another story this week was about the efficacy of Tamiflu. and that some doctors were saying that it doesn't work. What's the latest word on Tamiflu?
So oseltamivir, being the sort of the generic name of this, has been studied, and we know a few things. First, if you give it in young, healthy people who get the influenza, you can take down the duration of illness, but that's not really where it's useful. The real use is when you use it in people with severe illness who are at higher risk, and the data coming from the 2009 influenza pandemic would show that if you give it to people who are at higher risk or having severe disease, you can improve outcomes.
It's expensive, and I guess the other question is, do you have to give it early on? I mean, if you've had symptoms for 2 or 3 days, it doesn't help. Is that correct?
You know, the big thing here that I'd like to people come home with is that the use of it, the more antivirals we use, we can also develop antiviral resistance. And so we need to be very cautious about how we use these antivirals. For people who would normally do very well with influenza, they actually should not be getting antiviral medications, even if they're in that first 24, 48-hour window, just because they're going to get better on their own. And to make sure these drugs are available for people who are at high risk, pregnant women or young people, people who are immunocompromised, for the medicine to be able to work for them, we need to be really judicious in how we use these antivirals.
Yeah. Let's talk about out or Tamiflu.
Let's talk about the difference between a cold and the flu, because like you said, it is that season.
Right.
And I think now everybody's starting to get nervous about getting the flu, since that's what's all over the news. How can you tell the difference between cold and flu?
In general, now we can look at within a population. If you have a city that's having an outbreak of cold, you're not going to have many hospitalizations and almost certainly no deaths. But if you have an outbreak of influenza, that'll be very different. Mm-hmm. Within a large population, you may very well may see some deaths, certainly some hospitalizations. But within a single person, if somebody is otherwise healthy, normal immune system, they may have a very mild influenza case, but they also may have those severe fevers and, mm-hmm. and cough and things like that, which we normally would associate with influenza that you wouldn't normally see with the cold virus. Mm-hmm.
So to me, I just say you feel terrible either way. Just stay home either way.
Yeah, you tend to feel worse with influenza.
Hands, wash your hands a lot.
That's a big thing, yeah.
Dr. Pratish Tosh, thanks so much for stopping by the studio. A great update on the flu. Infectious disease expert, flu expert, Dr. Pratish Tosh.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.
He's got to get back to his Christmas shopping. He's out. He stopped by during Christmas shopping.
We saved you some money, didn't we?
It's time
for a short break.
Yes.
Coming up, we'll talk with orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston, plus myth or matter of fact, poor posture can cause scoliosis, and Tracy has outgrown her scoliosis.
Myth or matter of fact.
I
can't wait to find out. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Huddleston at 507-282-1234 or tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's guest, orthopedic spine surgeon, Dr. Paul Huddleston. Dr. Huddleston, good to have you on the program. Welcome.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Tracy. Thanks for sharing me with the Mayo Clinic Radio audience.
Yes.
You know what you don't probably know about Dr. Huddleston? I'm not sure that you were here when he was on a few years ago, but he's been fighting for your freedom more times than you may even know. How many times have you been to Afghanistan?
I've lost count. No,
really?
No. Actually, I've been to Afghanistan once, mm-hmm. and in Iraq several times.
And wow. Your stint, what, 6 months at a time, have you been gone, or 3 to 6? What is it?
The first time was almost a year. Wow. Gone, participating in military health, mm-hmm. military medicine, and subsequent stints have been a lot more palatable. About 4 months, 3-4 months. At a time.
And fair number of spine injuries did you see while you were there?
Lots of spine injuries, mostly extremity injuries from a lot of the blasts and the mines and a lot of the IEDs that we were reading about on the news.
Yeah.
How is it that you got interested as a young man in studying the spine and helping people with their backs?
It's mentors. You bump into people during your training and they impress upon you positively and you find something that you feel like you can help with and change. Patients help too. Mm-hmm. You meet a special patient that really impresses upon you.
Who were your mentors at Mayo Clinic?
I worked with Rudy Clausen, one of the first spine surgeons at the clinic.
Great guy.
Absolute great guy. Taught a lot. Was right there when the history books were being written about scoliosis at the University of Minnesota with Dr. Moe, as well as Brad Currier, one of my senior partners,
awesome.
And Mike Yazemski. There's many others, but yes.
Yeah, you had some great mentors, didn't you?
Absolutely. When Tom Shives, too.
Include him in that
Thank
list.
Thank goodness you didn't go into that field.
Well, when we first talked about the topic of scoliosis was mentioned, I said, oh, for kids... And people, no, adult scoliosis, that you're quite passionate about talking about adult scoliosis. And I didn't even know there was such a problem. I honestly thought, because it was told to me, oh, you grow out of it. It's something you have as a kid and you grow out of it. So is just adult scoliosis childhood scoliosis that someone did not grow out of? Is that what that is?
I think a lot of adult scoliosis is the residual or the remnants of what one went through when they were a child.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, people can get pretty severe changes in their spine just with arthritis, too.
Ah.
And if you additionally suffer from osteoporosis, then all three of those things together can make things, you know, really difficult.
How do kids develop it? I mean, what is it that's happening that has it start in the first place?
With kids, I think you can think about how they get scoliosis predominantly three different ways. One, you're born with it. There's just number one, something special about the way you were formed in your mother's womb.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you get it at some point after birth from some special shape in the spine, either an extra bone or a growth plate that's closed too soon.
Okay.
And then there's the most common scoliosis, which is what we talk about most frequently, idiopathic scoliosis. This occurs usually around the growth spurts in young boys and girls, more commonly in girls than boys. And
idiopathic meaning we really don't know what causes it.
Absolutely, Tom.
And is it? And I remember that it was, well, the taller kids are usually more susceptible to it. So the faster you grow, are you more susceptible to scoliosis?
I think it's just the growth. Hmm. That means without the potential to grow, there's no potential to grow abnormally or into a special shape.
Hmm.
You know, it's in our root. Our orthopedics was the word started by a French doctor a long time ago in the 18th century, and the word itself means straighten the child.
So more common in females than males. Any reason for that?
There's been some genetic associations, but I think that has. I'm not aware of an exact cause and effect. There's genetic testing that can be done. But it's something that they definitely experienced earlier. It was the root of the school screening programs that were so popular in about half the states in the United States.
When you have scoliosis as a child, what's the most common way that you treat it? And only a small percentage of these kids have scoliosis severe enough to require surgery, right?
Absolutely. A very good pediatric orthopedist by the name of Bill Shaughnessy, William Shaughnessy, had researched this and showed that you had to really screen about 500 kids to find somebody that you found with scoliosis. And then a very fraction of those children actually went on to be braced, and even a smaller piece of the pie went on to have surgical treatment.
Who does require surgery?
Children that are very young. They have a lot of growth potential left. Children that have a very large curve, that means they're already well along the way to having a special shape to their spine. The older you are, the smaller your curve, the more common it's going to be for you to, quote, grow out of it, unquote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And why is that bad? Why do you need to straighten it out?
If at the higher ends of the curve, for example, in children with really, really large curves, it can start to compress the chest cavity, cause problems with the heart and the lungs. It can also cause them to not be able to reach their ultimate or their maximum growth or height.
One follow-up question. The people who end up having scoliosis as an adult, most of them had it as they were when they were children, and it progressed over time. Or do they get scoliosis for another reason?
I think it's multiple reasons. That's certainly a very common way. Additionally, people can get it by the sagging of the spine or the shape of the spine as they age with osteoarthritis, or what you and I would know as just regular age-related arthritis. Sometimes, as I said before, especially in peri- or postmenopausal women, they can get osteoporosis superimposed on the arthritis. And then if they had idiopathic scoliosis when they were younger, then you have just the perfect trifecta to cause some problems.
And the problem with osteoporosis is that the vertebra then collapse, and then that helps cause the deformity.
Correct. The collapsing most commonly is collapsing forward or producing kind of a what we would call a kyphosis or a forward bend, but it can go any direction.
I have a myth or matter of fact for you. Poor posture can cause scoliosis. Is that a myth or is that a fact?
Myth.
It's a myth.
It's a myth.
So why do we always say sit up straight?
Because we need a reason for our children to sit up straight.
All right. Well, on that line, back to kids, carrying a backpack that's too heavy can cause scoliosis. Is that a myth or fact?
That's a myth, too. But I think there's some legitimate concerns about heavy backpacks causing back pain in children. I think that's a good reason enough to consider lightening the load.
When do you decide that an adult's scoliosis or curvature of the spine is bad enough that they need an operation? And tell us what's involved.
No, that's a very good question. Trying to decide who to talk to about the surgery is challenging. First of all, I think just from a 20,000-foot level, there's some understanding that there may be a lot of surgery going on in the United States, and maybe there's too much spine surgery. And what do I mean? Maybe people are not doing as well from the surgery as they could be because they were operated on too soon, or the indications were too vague or too loose. So I want to make sure that someone's not circumvented the normal, appropriate, non-operative measures too. Physical therapy, time, medication, allowing just a normal time to heal.
And then if you make that decision, it's not something that you take lightly, because surgery for curvature of the spine in an adult or a kid is a huge deal, isn't it?
It's a very big deal, yes, Tom. It is additionally harder as an adult. With children, we have the benefit of youth. We heal faster. We tend to scar less. Our infection rate may be less. It's all a much bigger deal as you get over skeletal maturity.
All right, spine surgery with orthopedic surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk about degenerative disease of the spine, including degenerative disc disease and arthritis, plus spinal stenosis.
Yeah, bone health, how to keep your bones healthy to prevent this layering of trouble from happening.
Particularly important for women to avoid osteoporosis. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest, orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston, coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams.
Plus, you can always tweet us your comments and questions at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. How much does lifestyle influence your health? Well, when it comes to people with atrial fibrillation, the most common heart rhythm issue, a new study shows lifestyle matters a lot. Researchers from the University of Adelaide found these patients can have their long-term outcomes greatly improved with aggressive management of their underlying risk factors. These researchers studied people who had cardiac ablation procedures to stop the bad rhythms. Some of the patients also had intensive risk factor management programs, things like weight control, blood pressure, sugar levels, smoking, and cholesterol. They found those who managed their lifestyle were 5 times more likely to have long-term survival without any further heart rhythm issues. This was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Researchers say it's never too late to start living a healthy lifestyle. And from Mayo Clinic, a phase 1 clinical trial of a drug called nivolumab found that the immune-boosting drug is a highly effective therapy for Hodgkin's lymphoma. They showed it was safe and led to an 87% response rate in patients who had failed on other treatments. Here's Dr. Stephen Antle.
This is, again, a very promising therapy for patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma, and trials are currently underway and, in fact, accruing very quickly to expand the testing of this nivolumab agent in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. So there is a large, again, multi-center study underway, which is accruing patients. Obviously, the next step beyond that would be to begin to look at combination approaches, because other agents have activity and in combination may be very promising for the future.
The drug has already demonstrated benefit in the treatment of other cancers, such as melanoma, kidney cancer, lung cancer, and bladder cancer. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, you might have heard about the so-called superbugs. They're bacteria that are resistant to almost all antibiotics. Well, a treatment pioneered at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Vaccine Research is far more effective than traditional antibiotics at stopping the growth of these drug-resistant bacteria. The findings in the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy are good news in the fight against these bugs. A lead researcher says it's critical to develop these new defenses against the drug-resistant bacteria that threaten the lives of our most vulnerable patients. These bugs can hit nursing homes and hospitals hard. They're testing the drugs in the lab and animal models, and will start clinical trials to test them on people. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Information You Want from Specialists Who Know. We are online, on air, and on iHeartRadio. And by the way, if you want to listen to this program live, you can go to KROCAM.com and you can listen on your smartphone.
That's right.
Also, why do they call it a smartphone? Because I figured it's smarter than me. And if I just knew how to use everything on it. Yeah.
And you got a new one, so now you got to learn all new deal.
I know. And
that's Merry Christmas.
Even worse. Yeah.
All right. And don't forget, you can tweet us too at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio, and we have got all kinds of tweets. Do you want to go through some of them right now? Very
it's
good.
Up to you. Yep.
All right. Gabrielle asked, does scoliosis make you shorter than you're supposed to be?
No, that's a great question. It depends on when it is. So the answer, yes, I think. If you think of the spine as going in from one point to the other, from your head down to your bottom, any detour or zigging or zagging of the spine is going to take a little bit of that height away. And certainly if you have the scoliosis early in life, such as a child or a baby, then the effects of the growth can be quite profound.
What of the patients that you have operated on, what's the most height you have regained? You know?
Wow.
Inch and a half, 2 inches maybe.
Wow. Really?
See, so that's how much.
In a tall young lady.
Gabrielle, right on.
Yeah, Jason says, I have pretty bad scoliosis. The only problem, it's in my neck and not in my back. Neck kind of is part of the back for this purpose. Unfortunately, there's no surgery option, so he has to deal with it the rest of his life. First of all, is that true? Are there surgical options if you have a scoliosis issue, if it corrects in your neck?
You are correct. The spine, the next part of the spine. So yes, there are some operations that do involve correcting that, but they're not common, fortunately, not necessary. But maybe people would like to know how big these operations are. You know,
So scoliosis. You can have scoliosis of the cervical or neck portion of the spine, isolated to that part of the spine.
It's usually at the top end of a thoracic curve that's already there.
So a chest curve. So they're kind of together, but you can fix that, can't you?
Well, we would hope so.
Yeah. So tell us how you do that. Tell us what's involved in a, I know this is big surgery, but kind of walk us through it. What do you have to do to straighten someone's spine?
The straightening of the spine is done even in this enlightened age of 2014 with minimally invasive procedures with cuts. So we still have to make cuts on the patients. Sometimes the incisions are on the front of the spine, sometimes they're in the back of the spine, and sometimes some combination of the two.
So you have to go what we call front and back.
Yes, sir.
To correct the curvature. So you have to go through the chest or through the abdomen and do part of the operation from in front, and then do the second part of the operation from behind.
That's
correct.
To
get it all straightened out.
That's correct.
Wow.
A major part of the deformity occurs through the joints themselves. So part of the operation is surgically removing the joints, cutting them out with saws or tools, and then replacing them with some sort of filler to help the body heal, but also straighten the spine. And then at the same day or later day, depending on the stress the patient's feeling from the operation, we make a posterior incision and use...
Behind.
In the behind, yes. And use things that could be thought of as simply as bolts and screws and rods, trying to force the spine into a better balance.
That does not sound enjoyable nor comfortable or something that you would ever want to go through.
It can take several hours. Some of the scoliosis surgeries can be 6, 7, 8, 9 hours long.
And it must be quite painful afterwards, too. I mean, you've got nuts and bolts and and rods in your spine. I mean, do you have any mobility at all?
Hopefully not through the areas where those were placed. The goals, as I talk to patients, of the metal parts as they're placed in there are to serve as a cast on the inside, not on the outside. In the good old bad days of scoliosis surgery, we placed people in horrific casts for 4 to 6 months at a time, and often at bed rest for prolonged periods before they were allowed to get up. So I believe the advances in the metal are an improvement.
You know, I didn't even mention we're taking phone calls, did I?
507-282-1234.
Spine surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston.
Elaine doesn't even need you to tell her that because she's on the line. She's a great listener. Good morning, Elaine. Go right ahead with your question.
My question to the doctor is the safety and benefits of Forteo, and is that a fairly new drug?
All right. And explain what that is, Dr. Huddleston.
Yes, ma'am. Elaine, that's a great question about bone health. Forteo is a medication that's used by doctors, usually primary care doctors or endocrinologists. These are the doctors that specialize in hormone therapy to try to augment people's low bone density, or what you and I would commonly know as osteoporosis. It's not usually a first-line drug because it's not usually necessary. It's also very expensive. We'd usually try to help someone's osteoporosis or thinning of the bones with calcium, gentle non-impact exercise, vitamin D, things like that first initially. But the Forteo has been very effective for treating people that have been resistant to those other serious problems.
And you think it's quite safe?
I think there's a very good use for it. We try not to use Forteo in people that have a history of cancer or malignancy because there's a concern that that might exacerbate that. So, yes, ma'am.
Yep, no medication, completely safe. Every one of them has side effects, but Forteo, it's my understanding, is a pretty safe medication.
Thank you, Elaine. And can we just, the bone health piece, the fitness and exercise component of that, should we be doing weight-bearing exercises, or what should you do for that, the fitness part of it?
You don't have to do very much, actually, but it's very important that we try to get closer to weight-bearing. Mm-hmm. People that are, through no fault of their own, chair-bound or not able to get a lot of standing walking exercise can suffer fairly severe osteoporosis. I like to think of the astronauts. We shoot really healthy people into space, and because of the absence of the gravity or the ability to their bones to feel the weight, they can experience very profound osteoporosis in a short period of time. So on Earth here, we like to avoid impact exercise, especially if you have osteoporosis, because we don't want people to fracture. But gentle loading of the bone absolutely helps.
Yep, bone responds to stress. And it's important for you to exercise to keep your bones strong. It's that simple. It's a fairly straightforward relationship. You know, it looks like the listeners are going to ask all the questions today, and that's fine.
Yep, 507-282-1234. We're going to go to Sandy because she has a question that also was a tweet that we just got tweeted in. So we'll kill two birds with one stone on this one. Good morning, Sandy. What's your question?
Good morning. I'm a young lady in my 60s, and I've been 5'7" all my life until I was about 55 years old, and then I lost 2 inches. And in the last little over a year, I've been going to a chiropractor, and I am now 5'6", and I really don't have any problems connected to this, but I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on the chiropractors?
Because if they're straightening out the spine with manipulations, does that help, or what do you think about that? Thanks,
right.
Sandy.
As a spine care specialist, I have a great support and interest in all people doing care for the spine. I'm not aware of any long-term research or evidence that shows that we can manipulate manually the spine into correction. What I am certain of, though, is that if you're feeling some benefit from that, then I think that that's a good thing. I think that long-term, women, all women that are peri or postmenopausal should keep in mind that they tend to lose height for two reasons. One, we all lose some height through the joints of the spine, the disjoints, male or female. But as women, additionally, you're at risk to lose through the bones themselves. Remember, osteoporosis weakens the bones, and you can have fractures through the bones, which cause you to lose that some of that vertical height, too. So you have
They get compressed a little bit.
You have a two-punch that's potentially stacked against you.
Thanks for calling in, Sandy. Mary has a question about her husband's scoliosis diagnosis. Good morning, Mary.
Hi. Yes. Both my husband and my young adult daughter have been diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis, and I'm just calling to find out if there's any surgery that can be done to correct that problem.
First of all, what is that, Dr. Huddleston?
Well, Mary, it's. I'm sorry to hear that your family's suffering from that disease. What you're describing is inflammatory. It's basically an autoimmune disease where the body attacks the spine and can create a lot of back pain and some stiffening of the spine.
Yeah, that's what ankylosing means.
Sure.
And spondylitis is inflammation. Ankylosis means that it becomes stiff and sometimes can become fused. Now, what about fused or the bones get together, so fused together.
Yes, so, almost like a weld, like a mechanical weld.
Yeah. Now, if the deformity or pain gets bad enough, do you have an? Are there surgical options?
With ankylosing spondylitis, besides the pain, one of the very particular things that happens is people tend to be pitched forward a bit, and it's really that pitch forward position, leaning forward position, that causes people a lot of dysfunction. And that can be surgically corrected, but unfortunately, in someone with a really stiff spine, in addition to all the mechanics we talked about before with the incision and the rods, we almost always have to cut the spine too, which is called an osteotomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cut it to straighten it. Mary, does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you so much.
Oh, you
thanks
bet.
For calling
thanks.
In.
Yep.
507-282-1234. Linda has a question about her granddaughter. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Great show and great guests.
Thank you.
My granddaughter is 17 and was diagnosed a couple years ago with scoliosis, was braced for a year. Does she have to worry any further into her adult life?
Well, Linda, that's a great question. The concern with anybody who's been diagnosed with scoliosis and had some sort of treatment, that means anybody else who was told, nope, there's nothing to do, but we're talking about the people that had a brace or some other intervention. It depends particularly on how big the curve was when they had it and how much growth is left. Basically, scoliosis is a problem where there's still potential to grow. Think of a tree, a young tree, where we can steer it or turn it or with posts around it and straps, straighten it out. Is that once the tree becomes an adult tree, it doesn't move or change the shape that much. And the same with adults. Once they become a skeletal adult, which in females is usually about 2 years after they start their period, so, you know, it's always changing, but around 17, they're going to be kind of in that position for their life. Later in life, they may be at risk for osteoarthritis or osteoporosis, but that's not necessarily going to have anything to do with her scoliosis as a youth.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Linda.
A skeletal adult. I like that. Yes. That's good.
Yes, skeletal adult.
Can you say what is the, for medical testing for adult scoliosis, how does an adult go in and say, maybe that's the reason why I'm having some pain in my back, or what is that process?
The initial process would be a history and exam, a good history and exam with your spine care provider. Additional x-rays may be done. These are we attempt to minimize x-rays due to the radiation exposure when we don't need them, but they can provide some value in some areas of the spine, particularly in between the chest and the low back. It can be very difficult to see curves, and then the x-ray, I think, is a good assessment. MRI scans or CT scans are additionally ordered too. And for women, again, or men that are under hormone suppression for prostate cancer, we additionally do a DEXA scan, a bone density scan, to try to find patients that are have low bone density.
And if you get to a point where you can say, oh, there's something there that maybe we need to watch, then just are you in the just we'll watch it and monitor it and see if you start to have problems? Is that's what you do?
Absolutely. There's no intent to shortcut the normal healing process or the normal therapeutic process that someone could have through physical therapy or their own active exercise program. We would only continue to follow them if there was some continued symptoms, no like routine or mandatory x-rays.
Sure. All right, Janet is on the line. She has a question about arthritis. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. My question is, I'm 75 and I have been having a lot of back pain. I can't really stand up straight when I'm walking, and I'm told that I have scoliosis. And, of course, I have arthritis in my back. And I'm wondering if perhaps wearing a back brace would be a good thing. So far, I've just been doing exercises and stuff for it. And I was wondering about having a brace on my back.
Oh, Janet, we wanted to talk about that, so I'm glad you brought it up. Dr. Huddleston, what about braces and corsets for back pain? In particular, this Janet's
with arthritis.
Problem.
Yep.
Yes, Janet, I'm sorry to hear about your trouble. It can be quite frustrating. One thing to consider is that although we often get some temporary benefit from wearing the braces, that means it just feels good to have that extra support. The long-term concern from your spine, you know, care provider would be that the constant use of the brace might lead to some muscle weakening or some further loss or shielding of the bone. As Dr. Tom Shives had said, the bone responds from forces, gentle loading. So you have this compromise between trying to be symptomatic, you know, trying to be help someone with their discomfort, and realizing that if we wear the brace all the time, it's probably going to cause us to be weak long term.
So you like it part time. You don't have anything against braces or corsets, particularly if they help, but not for full time use.
Correct. Absolutely.
All right. Hope that helps, Janet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. How about Bob? Because we want to talk about steroids, and I really want you to talk about spinal stenosis because it's such a huge problem.
Good morning, Bob. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Yeah, I was at the clinic. I had a bulging disc in my lower back, and I had steroidal injections, two of them, and now my back's just been just wonderful. And I was wondering, how did that help it? Did the bulge go away, or what happened?
Yeah, good question. Steroids and back pain, and what are they good for, Dr. Huddleston?
So, Bob, I don't know if you have scoliosis or not. If it's just isolated back pain, then we have found in general that the steroid injections work best for leg symptoms, leg trouble, what you and I would know as sciatica, or pain going from the back down the leg. I have not been able to predict who with pure back pain is going to benefit from the steroid injections themselves. The steroid is two things mostly. One, it's a very powerful pain medication, but it additionally is an anti-inflammatory that can reduce local swelling. So I would think that if your symptoms were caused by arthritis, osteoarthritis, then that may be why you benefited from that. We certainly do use steroids in other joints that are arthritic.
By the way, if you are on the line, and the lines have been full practically the whole hour, hang on there and we'll try to get to your phone call after the program if Dr. Huddleston's willing to stay. And I suspect you are, huh?
Absolutely.
All right, tell us about spinal stenosis. What is it and can you fix it with a knife?
That's a great question. I think of spinal stenosis as a secondary effect. So what do I mean by that? People get arthritis in the spine first, almost always. And then the accumulation of arthritis or the swelling of the joints. And Tom, I would say all we have to do is look at our hands and look at, we all might have some knuckles that are a little big or a little swollen. We have those same type of knuckles in the spine. So when they become swollen and enlarged, they can secondarily crowd out the nerves, which causes all sorts of problems.
And you can usually help with that if it's severe enough, right?
Yes, sir. It involves not curing the disease. And I spend a lot of time talking to people about that nobody's curing arthritis. We're just restoring the space. Think of it as a renovation job, restoring the space in the house to, where the nerves live. So we hope people improve.
Yeah, well, it's good to know that there is an option for that difficult problem. Dr. Paul Huddleston, orthopedic surgeon, spine surgeon, Mayo Clinic Rochester, thanks so much for being with us.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we're going to tell you about next week's program. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll review the top medical stories of 2014. You know, there were so many great advances last year or this year. How did you ever pick which ones we're going to talk about?
We only have so much time. We have to talk really fast.
Yeah, okay.
One of our favorite stories, or at least mine, is Dr. Russell's using measles to help with Stacey Erhaltz's. We ran this show back at Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Time.
Yeah, she had this
with
big
her multiple
lump
myeloma.
She had this such a big lump on her head, she named it Ernie or
that's
something.
Right,
and
that's
it all
right.
Went away with this measles
so
vaccine.
We'll talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about, hopefully Dr. Ahlquist can join us to talk about the new less invasive test for colon cancer.
Cologuard, huge deal.
It's a very big deal. Also, we've got some doctors from Arizona that are going to call in because they're using robots down there for two purposes. One, to help diagnose stroke in some of the outlying areas out in the countryside. And another is on the sidelines during football games to help evaluate concussion if that happens during a game.
Really?
With a robot.
A lot of exciting stuff. But, you know, we've had so many great guests over the years. I just don't know how you pick the topics we're going to talk about. But I'm looking forward to it.
And also, I should say, and then using stem cells for ALS, that's part of it too. Well, we hope that you will join us and be part of that program. For more information discussed today, visit our website, mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Rich Dietman, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Rich Peterson. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and spine surgeon Dr. Paul Huddleston, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.